You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Music critic Wynne Della Coma and National Public Radio host Peter Sagal explore Dr. Atomic with a remarkable panel of experts from the worlds of opera, art, history, and physics, backstage at Lyric.
One of the reasons to write new operas is that what we are living through cannot be expressed in old languages. We actually need to be finding the new languages to describe things that our grandparents didn't go through, and things that their grandparents did not go through. Some things are qualitatively and specifically completely different, starting with July 16th, 1945.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. For this episode, we're playing an audio transcript of the third and final panel discussion from the Lyric Opera Discovery Series Symposium on Dr. Atomic. For those of you who may not be aware of the Discovery Series, it's panel discussions featuring singers, conductors, directors, and scholars. We do one session per opera. They usually take place a few days prior to the opening of each production. The Discovery Series is open to the public, and it's a great way to get up close and personal with our artists. You can check out our website at www.lyricopera.org for dates, tickets, and complete Discovery Series information. We're including all of the Discovery Series sessions as part of the Backstage at Lyric podcast. This final panel discussion in our Dr. Atomic Symposium features a discussion among all of our panelists, after which they field questions from the audience. Music critic Wynne Della Coma and National Public Radio host Peter Sagal are the moderators. The panelists are Dr. Atomic composer John Adams, director-librettist Peter Sellers, baritone Gerald Finley, Art Institute of Chicago president and Eloise W. Martin director James Cuno, Pulitzer Prize-winning Oppenheimer biographer Martin Sherwin, University of Chicago physicist Henry Frisch, and Nobel Prize winner Norman Ramsey, who had been a chief scientist at Los Alamos. I hope you enjoy the discussion.
The origin of this hour was simply this, that we were having a preliminary meeting to discuss it. Henry was on the phone, and we were saying, well, at one point we're going to talk to you about science and history, and he said, I'm not interested in science and history. I want to talk to the opera guys. So we decided that we take the third of this three-hour session and allow these people who we assumed would have a lot to discuss to talk to each other. So Henry, if you don't mind, and I didn't warn you of this since it was almost your idea, do you want to begin?
Well, I should just say that I read the libretto. I asked for the libretto. And I was struck by, first of all, it's brilliant. Second of all, it captures so well. Now, you know, I was at Los Alamos. I was born in August 44. So, and my parents, I asked my mother, how did you leave? And she said, as soon as the bomb was dropped, we left. So I wasn't there, but somehow I've read the Smythe Report, and I grew up with this somehow in the family. And I thought Peter and John captured so well the fundamental tragedy, the spirit of the place, the quality of the people, and also Bob Wilson, who, now Norman knew Bob better than I did, but who was really a hero for me. So I wanted to talk to them. How did they get it so right? And so that's... So anyhow, that's why I wanted the chance. Now, we should just let it go from there, I think.
John, do you want to jump in there?
Well, thank you. First of all, I just want to say how moved I was by your comment of feeling that creating this work of art could actually maybe bring this subject to the minds of
the public. You know, when we create art, at least when I create art, I'm not exactly sure why I do it. And I certainly don't think that art can change the way people behave on a global level. I think if you need to make lives better for people, you first have to feed and clothe them, and right there, that's a huge undertaking. But the thought that a scientist of your stature could feel that way about that this opera actually has you know, some moral value is something that affects me. It really gives me some courage to go ahead and continue creating works of art. As far as getting it right with these characters, I think, you know, you read and you try to read in between the lines of the people involved. In the case of Oppenheimer, I was most affected by reading his letters. There's a wonderful book of Oppenheimer's letters, and they date from when he was a teenager to through his Harvard period, and he very often wrote to his younger brother, Frank. And the letters are, you know, they're arrogant and a bit stagey and pompous as he's a young man. But as he grows older, this immense wisdom and this great sadness comes into the letters. By the time he's writing letters after, you know, the war, they have a positively elegiac quality to them. And I got my feeling about Oppenheimer from that, and also from the poetry that he loved, so that when it came to writing the music, I felt that I could live inside this man. I couldn't do the math that he did, but I felt very much the tonalities of his being. With Kitty, she was such an attractive figure to compose for, because I felt on the one hand a brilliant, intelligent, scientifically educated woman, a woman who had a past in communism, who had been married to a communist organizer, a hard-drinking, hard-smoking, at times trash-talking faculty wife, who really must have been something to keep the fidelity and the love of this extraordinary man right up to the end of his life. And so I kind of imparted to her a somewhat of a Cassandra-like vision, that having to sit in this miserable little cottage while these men were off doing something and supposedly, wink, wink, not knowing what they were doing, prompted a kind of visionary awareness in her. So when you're writing dramatic work, you live inside these characters. And one of the great, great thrills and joys of working with Peter is that his greatest gift is empathy. When he talks about a character, he goes so deep into every complex of their psyche, of their desires, of what's not being said, of what's not being spoken. So that's what makes writing for the stage so thrilling, and it's what also prods new musical ideas.
And what John writes is literally what's between the lines. It's the music. And that whole world, which is amorphous to most of us, is very vivid and highly structured for John. And that's where I think of working, that I'm working with an atomic physicist every day, is because all of these things that for us are very obscure, John communicates. In images of incredible complexity, which is what connects what we do to science, which is you're trying. There are not enough notes on this page. I've got to get a page that... I mean, just monstrous numbers of notes. And these, you know, several thousand notes.
Yeah, but just think how many neutrons there are in an atom.
You know, those several thousand notes on those two pages go by in probably 28 seconds. And John is working inside of time with such depth and such layers of articulation. And so what you're getting is a way to speak with complexity about something that is complex, which is why opera is such a satisfying form, because the complexity actually is inherent in the fact that a composer would spend 2 weeks on 2 minutes or 2 months on 2 minutes in some cases. And what it means to look inside of time and insist on many, 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 many things unfolding all at the same time. And what makes this day so overwhelming is, first of all, to be with people I admire this much and wasn't sure I'd get to meet. And I'm overwhelmed, frankly. And one is, being a historian is a very heroic and courageous act, and Marty Sherwin has put himself out there for decades now as willing to say difficult things in this country, where, as you know, the Smithsonian was almost shut down over trying to just discuss Hiroshima. Where to this day, if you visit the Los Alamos Historical Museum at Los Alamos, it's like a gift shop at Disneyland. You know, the refusal to acknowledge anything that's going on or went on is staggering. And Aristotle, who we've been quoting a lot today, used to say that that poetry is more important than history, because history is about what happened and poetry is about what might happen. And in fact, this opera doesn't exist to settle old scores about who was doing what to whom in 1945 in July. This opera exists, as Norman said so eloquently, to ask us, what are we doing right now? We can argue forever over what Oppenheimer thought he was doing. But as Norman said, this is not a historical question. And it's John who got to the, you know, the opera ends halfway to where we thought it would go. I mean, we already had 3.5 hours of opera. We had to stop. But John refused to set the last things I gave him, because he said, no, this cannot end. There can be no ending to this piece. We are living in this same era. And the people who were present in the desert at Alamogordo on July 16th and watched the sky turn orange and purple, are us sitting here in this auditorium in lovely neutral brown colors. The decisions they had to face are the decisions we have to face. And we can criticize them for what they did or did not understand. The issue in our generation is going to be, how can every one of these nuclear weapons be removed from the face of the earth now, within this generation, not Iran, not North Korea, but every one of them held by everyone. And can we finally put closure to this era and say this was an era in human history, things went very far down this path, and then people said that's the wrong path. Nobody has to put a genie back in the bottle. We now simply have to control nuclear energy. And it is best controlled through a democratic process. Well, although one of the nice things about this historical work is we can talk about times when people actually were elected. But sorry, a little moment of nostalgia. to return to the future. What it will take is a movement, and what it will take is a new movement and a new consciousness, and particularly in a time where these scientists tried so hard to educate the public. What does it take to really say, no, we're all living in a democracy. All of us as citizens are not just taking care of ourselves, but we have a larger responsibility to participate in a larger set of questions about what's going on the Earth right now. And that's one thing these operas do so powerfully. Mozart literally wrote the soundtrack for the build-up to the French Revolution with The Marriage of Figaro, for the explosion itself with Don Giovanni, and for the bitter aftermath with Così fan tutte. Verdi has a political assassination in almost every opera and was writing about what it meant to throw off an occupying army. Or, in the case of Lyric Season this year, Verdi was absolutely outraged about the state of prostitution in Paris and wrote an opera in contemporary costumes that shocked the public with its not only exposé, but again, emotional depth and power. And to me, you know, John read it earlier in the night. Unimaginable is the word that the scientists keep using when they're writing. And of course, I think one of the tasks is to use our imaginations and to try and imagine. And that act of imagination is an act of liberation because it brings you back to your responsibilities. And what I love is, and you'll see in this opera, Jerry Finley mastering John's rhythms, which are not just because John likes to write difficult music. But John is genuinely in this opera dealing with an unstable universe. And so it changes meter every two bars. And instability is something Jerry Finley has to live with. But also, what is so moving coming to the opera is watching him master it and say, okay, these things are difficult, and we can master them. We don't have to just throw up our hands and say, it's too hard. But here are a whole group of people doing something very hard, very well. Let's take courage from that.
Can I say something?
Go ahead, of course.
I'd like to sort of segue into the connection between art and history here. I think in a different way than I'll say it, Peter made this point, that nothing that happens ever had to happen the way it did, certainly not decisions of government. And that's where art comes in and connects with history. What are the counterfactuals? What are the things that, in effect, could have happened that didn't happen? Just imagine a little thought experiment that Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, who was in charge of the Manhattan Project, who raised some serious questions about the impact of nuclear weapons after World War II. He gave a memorandum to Truman on April 25th, 1945, explaining to Truman what the atomic bomb was all about. And in that memorandum, he says, we are building a weapon that can destroy civilization or save civilization. He didn't take the next step and say we must not use it, but he did make some recommendations that would have led to the end of the war without using nuclear weapons, and those recommendations were not taken. Let's say that happened. What would have happened after the war? Well, we spent $2 billion on this weapon. We invested a lot of other materiel and scientific talent in that weapon. There would have been a congressional hearing, of course. Henry Stimson would have been one of the witnesses, and he would have been asked, Mr. Stimson, how can you possibly justify the fact that this bomb was ready on August 6, 1945, and it was not used against the Japanese, who bombed Pearl Harbor, Bataan Death March, did this and that to China, and so on and so forth. How do you explain yourself? And Stimson would have said what he said in that memorandum to Truman, that this is a weapon that could save civilization if it was used properly or not used, or it could destroy civilization. And he would have gone on to say that we are a country with our own values. These values are different from the Nazi values we were fighting against. And we didn't need to use the weapon in order to end the war. And we decided we would not use the weapon. This is a weapon beyond the pale. Now imagine if that had been the introduction of nuclear weapons, how different this country and even politicians would have looked at the nuclear weapon. Instead of being this iconic monster that ended World War II, it would have been seen as a weapon that was too horrible to use to end the war. There were better ways to do it. History, I suggest, would have been very different with respect to the nuclear arms race and to the problems that we're sitting and facing today. And I think that's where art and history come together.
But can I just respond to that, what you're saying, Marty, because, you know, I too, after reading and working on this opera over a period of 5 years, I can't make my mind up either, you know, whether it was the right thing or
You've
not.
You've got another 20 years you have to put into it.
But the grim feeling I have, which was amplified by seeing a film clip of the young congressman from Texas, Lloyd Benson. You remember him? You're no JFK. During the lead up to the Korean War, standing in front of a map of China, recommending which Chinese cities should be bombed with nuclear weapons. And I have this really grim feeling that the bomb would have been used, probably by the Americans, possibly by the Russians. But I just it's a kind of a feeling that because it was out there and it had not been used, that it was almost inevitable that it would be used at least once, simply because it was there. And in a sense, if it hadn't been used at the end of the Second World War, a much more terrible weapon, one of Teller's hydrogen bombs, may well have been used later on, a decade later.
Well, just very quickly, I don't think there would have been a hydrogen bomb, and the bomb would not have been seen as, you know, the foundation of our defense. But, of course, we could go on for a long time with this, and we're not going to do it.
I think on there, I agree with your worry. One of the worries is if it hadn't been used, it might have been used to start a war rather than end one. It was one of the things, that's what I think why the opera is a good thing to look at. It's one of the difficult issues that you can make. You can be either, you can have a position taken very conscientiously, which can be one that might make it better, or the same decision might make it worse.
I just wanted to ask John and Peter a question. We were talking earlier about you know, the paintings that were coincident with these early years of the 1940s, and how, generally speaking, they were either histrionic in their in their subject matter or and painting styles, or they were messy and dirty and filled with accidental incidents and so forth. And the question is, when we all see this opera, we'll see that that's not, in fact, how it's presented visually on stage. And so the question is, to John and Peter, how they envisioned our seeing the opera, and whether what we see here in Chicago is how they envisioned we would see it.
Well, John will see it tomorrow. He's just getting into town, so we'll find out. Just to say, the physical appearance that you'll see on stage, the designers, Adrian Lobel, the set designer, and Dunya Romkova, the costume designer, and Jim Ingalls, the lighting designer, have made a very special world, which is very, very spare. Adrian made the set like a Japanese no play. The floor is what you see, with the grooves from the Alamogordo test site that are still emblazoned in the desert to this day. And it's primarily the floor, and then a long horizon, which is, of course, your experience of the desert in New Mexico, but it's also the point of the opera, is the long horizon and what is on this horizon. Then you'll see very, very simple wooden poles moved, sticks, really we call them, you know, that were used to set up experiments in the desert, but of course are bleached and have this quality like bone, so that they are really, it's like X-ray, a cancer diagram. And it's very, very simple. A lot of people come expecting some big Steven Spielberg, you know, techno extravaganza. And of course, was not what Los Alamos was. Los Alamos, the bomb, had pieces of scotch tape and Kleenex in it.
Is this how it was in the Netherlands as well?
Simple. And yes, and so very, very simple. But then, of course, as you know, the main thing happening in the desert, and the main thing also that Oppenheimer spoke about a lot about the bomb, was light. Was this question of light in the desert, and this and a lot of the effects are all based on how these simple elements are lit. And then the costumes, I just have to tell you, Dunya spent two weeks in Los Alamos and collected a lot of samples from the landscape, leaves and twigs.
In fact, she commented that for a project that was so extremely secretive, there was an astonishing amount of documentary material.
And she's taken, you know, everybody on stage is wearing khakis, but she, in fact, gathered all of these things and put them on her work table, these leaves and twigs and parts of the landscape, and all of the khaki has been dyed to match those parts of the landscape. So no two khakis are the same, and you're seeing, as 150 people stand on stage, you see the landscape itself. And so that's the color world that is there, and all of the costumes are based on documented costumes, of course. But then there's the poetry, you know, and the hope is this meeting of the documentary and the poetic. And I really feel very strongly in this age where, leave the special effects to the Pentagon. You know, I really want to talk to the American public without special effects. Could we just concentrate on the topic for a moment and not have a bunch of distracting things to look at, to catch your eye, to divert the subject, is actually what we're asking for is concentration. And yes, let's all stay with this, you know, and finish the sentence together. And so one of the things that gets commented on is that the second act is too long, or there should be more visual, you know, kind of distraction. And for me, it's the opposite. It's that I want a restricted palette, which is one thing the desert is about. And then an extreme focus, which is what happens to you in the desert. You begin to have hyper-focus on small details. And that is, of course, what John's music is about. It's this incredibly finely detailed world where these subtle shifts are always moving. And that's, of course, what the characters themselves are going through. What the highly detailed, highly technical work of the bomb itself is about. But then also the fineness of the moral question. And so what we're trying to do is present a world of fineness.
Just a very quick comment. I had the privilege of seeing the opera in San Francisco, and I have never been able to get one moment in that opera, one scene in that opera, out of my head, a visual, that is as stunning for me as a representation of what the nuclear age is all about, as Guernica was with respect to the 1930s and the Spanish Civil War and the coming of World War II. And when you see it, the baby, Oppenheimer's baby, is in the crib. And over the crib is this nuclear weapon hanging, and this beautiful song is being sung by... is it Kitty? No, it's the maid, isn't it?
Pascualita.
Yes. And it's just... well, it's stunning. It's you must see it.
Well, I have to say, we have testimony here at the table. One of the most shocking and amazing things when you look at the photographs, and it strikes you right away, is the scientists are mostly young men. And the thing that upset General Groves, you know, the most about daily life at Los Alamos was he had to triple the size of the maternity ward because everyone was having babies. And the idea that you spend the day working on this project of mass death and then come home and hold your newborn baby, this image of that much life and that much death next to each other was just overwhelming. And so that does inform a lot of the second act. Yeah.
Do we have any further questions from our panelists to our panelists?
One question. Just thinking about the dangerous times in which we live, as it was articulated earlier, and thinking about with the end of the Soviet era and the sort of blossoming of the promise of democracy and so forth, and then the recognition that for quite some period of time that was a failed state, and the great danger was that this massive material of that was dangerous, the armaments would be made available to terrorists and so forth, we couldn't control them and so forth. And so the failed state has been converted and democracy has been converted into something that looks less like democracy and more like a successful one-party state. So it seemed to me that while thinking about how, thinking about how we had to worry about things, that at least with regard to the rebirth, if not the Soviet Union, of a strong Russian state, that the worst that could happen with Putin's control over power is that we would have another Cold War. And the Cold War, in hindsight, and as you articulated, seemed more sort of imaginable, more acceptable than the unknown that we experienced briefly and perhaps look forward to in other parts of the world. But do you have any comment about sort of the condition of things in the current state of Russia with regard to the materials there?
Mm-hmm.
Any response?
Who knows what kind of nukes the Russians have now, I think was the question.
it's a very big topic. I mean, the whole history of the Soviet nuclear arsenal from the end of the Cold War to today is a long story. Initially, Ukraine gave up the nuclear weapons and one other breakaway country from the Soviet Union. The United States, under Sam Nunn's leadership, managed to put aside a lot of money to work with the Soviets to build down their nuclear arsenal. And the nuclear arsenals of the Soviet Union and the United States have been built down, but the Soviet Union still has a significant number of nuclear weapons, and we have a more significant number of nuclear weapons. And they are still two very dangerous arsenals that, while no longer supposedly on hair trigger alert aimed at each other's cities, within a matter of 3 to 10 minutes, that can be changed. So the nuclear doomsday machines that we pointed at each other are still right there and pretty much ready to go, not just quite as ready to go as they were during the Cold War.
Shall we begin? I think we have half an hour left, or a little less. Let us try to get to some of your questions. I'm surprised only because of the, frankly, level of artistic genius we have on this panel, but most of the questions are for Dr. Ramsey, because I guess
okay,
beauty is trumped by experience here.
We will go back
and forth. It's a general question we'll start with, and Professor Ramsey, you can begin if you like, which was, how do you suppose Oppenheimer and the other real-life characters in this play, who you knew, would feel about how they are portrayed in the opera?
Feel about what?
How they are portrayed in the opera.
I think they are portrayed, they're complex individuals, and I think they did come out in the opera as complex individuals. But of course, the opera could only do one aspect of them, and I think the opera was fairly fair to everyone.
Can I just say one thing? I got into a brief email exchange with Wendy Teller, who is the daughter of Edward Teller, because I had asked if we could use some phrases from her father's memoirs. And her family were at first very against the idea, because most of the treatment of Teller in movies and plays was negative. So I said, well, I'll send you the libretto. And she sent back and said, it's okay, you can use it. But if you ask me, the opera's anti-science, which was take on.
This actually was a question from the audience. I'll just drop it in, which is that Edward Teller has been depicted variously. What was his attitude toward using the bomb on people?
What was Teller's attitude toward using? Well, Teller always claimed that he was against using the bomb at the end of the war, and that Oppenheimer talked him out of it, that he brought Szilard's petition not to use the atomic bomb against the Japanese Szilard sent it to Teller. Teller went to Oppenheimer to ask if he could pass it around, and Oppenheimer talked him out of it. Well, it is true that Oppenheimer was against passing this petition around. But I found a letter from Teller back to Szilard that showed clearly enough to me that Oppenheimer didn't have a lot of talking Teller out of to do. That's an interesting libretto line, and I could use in a... Set to music, it would have sounded better. But you get my point. So I think it's another case of disingenuousness on the part of Teller, who I do not have a lot of regard for.
I would just like to tell a story that John Adams told me 2 years ago or so. You were talking about the aftermath of Dr. Atomic in San Francisco, and you said that you were walking your dog one day and someone pulled over to the curb. And if you want to finish the story, it's great.
No, it's just, my comment was that, I write a lot of instrumental orchestral pieces, and people always come up and shake my hand and say how much they enjoyed it, or they wish they knew more about modern music,
I could have enjoyed it if they did.
But when it comes to opera, everybody has an opinion, and even to the point where I was just walking my dog down the street in Berkeley, and this Volvo comes cruising up, and a woman reaches over and rolls the window down and says, "I loved your opera, but I hated the way you treated Teller," and then she drove off. I think she meant that I was too kind to him.
Speaking as a public radio guy, you have to watch out for the ladies in the Volvos. They'll get you. You want to?
Yes, there's a question here, I think, for both John Adams and Peter Sellers. What other operas or musical works, if any, inspired or informed aspects of Dr. Atomic?
I'd also add to that any other narrative works, because this story, as you guys point out, have been told many times, films, books, TV, movies. Did you reflect on any of those, musical art narrative?
No, I think Dr. Atomic is really sui generis. It's there's nothing quite like it. You know, I love Wagner because I think Wagner's the great psychologist, and that, you know, with these absurd characters, you know, near Norse outfits that and magic Tarnhelms and things like that, that they're all just vehicles to get to psychological truths that are profoundly deep and can only be reached through this magical wedding of poetry and music. But that's on a very, you know, a very abstract level. But I don't think there were any models at all. You know, I mentioned science fiction movies, which I know that sounds a little cheeky, but I, you know, I was profoundly affected by them as a kid. All these black and white movies that would start with a nuclear explosion in the Nevada desert, and then something strange would happen, and then some beast or monster would come. Yeah, and I mean, it's funny, but at the same time, for a little kid, it was very, very psychologically disturbing, and you know that probably was, you know, a motivating factor. But I think the story itself was so operatic and so mythic that I didn't have to look for any models.
And again, the models just give you courage. You know, when somebody says Act Two is too long, and you say, "And what did you do during Götterdämmerung?"
Which is the topic of Act Two.
Yeah.
Did you bring your video game to your seat? I mean, one of the great things about the past is it just gives you courage to go forward and say, no, 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 don't ask for less. In fact, demand more and keep your standard very, very high. So in that sense, you know, we have fantastic precedents, and opera has been always very good at eschatology, at really taking people to this place where you imagine the end of the world. You know, and what is that? And then what is it to step back from that? And there are kind of fantastic, you know, Mozart ending Don Giovanni. There are fantastic images of that in the history of opera. So in that way, we were empowered. But I have to say, this material, one of the reasons to write new operas is that what we are living through cannot be expressed in old languages. We actually need to be finding the new languages to describe things that our grandparents didn't go through and things that their grandparents did not go through. Some things are qualitatively and specifically completely different, starting with July 16th, 1945.
This has been touched on in a couple of ways already this afternoon, but here's one question from the audience, again directed to you, Dr. Ramsey. Since, as we had said earlier, an atomic bomb had never been built or detonated, did you scientists truly know or understand the degree of destruction that it could cause if it was successful before you did it?
I think approximately yes.
All right, then.
You know, there's a little...
Now we know why you're not in the opera. You don't say enough. Set that. Why don't you? I'm sorry, I interrupted.
There's that little snippet in the Oppenheimer lecture that I played before. I don't remember if I played it for you, but at one point he says, we before the explosion, we calculated tonnage and destructive issues, et cetera, and some people said, well, it isn't so bad. But after July 16th, 1945, we didn't say that anymore. That seeing it was enough to, you know, sort of focus the mind on the consequences.
Well, let me make one comment on that on historically. Namely, that it was really a great worry at the time that one bomb was not enough to bring an end to the war. And therefore, an effort was made to make the use of the one or two that would be available as dramatic as possible. And for example, the bombs in that way, there was heavy bombing already going ahead. Most of the cities were pretty thoroughly bombed out. But so therefore, some cities were reserved from the other bomb. They were saved a lot of trouble so that they would be a dramatic demonstration. And that proved to be even more effective than thought.
I have a question here for Mr. Finley. Of all of the research that you did on Oppenheimer, what did you find to be the most valuable? Was it something you read or listened to or perhaps saw on film?
I think fundamentally it was the Bhagavad Gita, where the prince is in discussion with the Godhead, and he says, "Why do I have to go out and kill?" And God says, "It's not you who is killing, it is I who take life." And I have a feeling that for Oppenheimer, he had the sense that this was his duty, the gifts that he had as a human being, both intellectual and as a passionate poet, as a spiritual being. Somehow he had these ingredients in equal measure. And he had to, as a warrior of light, literally, trying to find that balance of existence, to justify his existence, to cope with his existence. He certainly went through enough cigarettes to put an end to his life a lot earlier than actually happened. And so this high, this extremely high intensity of passion for the spiritualism, I think was the only way he could have kept his sanity and kept the focus on guiding these amazing men to keep them focused on a project which they knew, as you've said, the effectiveness of destruction, of compromising our existence, and balancing that against the extreme thrill of the scientific project. And I feel like there was a sort of a triangle of romance, of as I say, passion, heart passion, spirituality, and scientific intellect, all in this, if you like, the three persons. And that's why, for me, the John Donne poetry, the Trinity of the Bhagavad Gita, the balance of home, work, and spiritualism is all incredibly well balanced. But I would say the Bhagavad Gita.
You know, one of the things that Oppenheimer's best friend, Isidore Rabi, said about him was that he would have been much more balanced as a human being if he had read the Talmud rather than the Bhagavad Gita.
How would you set the Talmud, though?
Well, Oppenheimer was Jewish, and Rabi had been brought up in an Orthodox Jewish family, and that was his point, was that Oppenheimer was running away from his Judaism, and And that, in a sense, added to not only the complexity of his personality, but the complexity of his life and his thinking.
The theory, I guess, being that if he had been true to his Jewish roots, then instead of dropping the bomb, they'd still be arguing about it.
Yes, right.
And John would have to set kvetching, which would be interesting. I'm going to paraphrase because we had a couple of questions, one on a technical issue, which is interesting, and one on a moral issue. Let me do the technical one first. I'll paraphrase. And that is, we've heard some language today about the necessity to eliminate nuclear weapons. To what extent, in order to do that, do we have to eliminate civilian nuclear power? Do we have to get rid of our reactors and our nuclear propulsion? Can that exist peacefully and fruitfully while we put away the nuclear weapons?
Well, just very briefly, from my point of view, nuclear power is the foundation of nuclear weapons because you can create weapons-grade uranium or plutonium out of a nuclear power plant. But with an appropriate inspection regime, and we have learned over the last administration that inspection regimes actually work, there's no reason why we couldn't have a nuclear power economy if it's believed that that's the right thing to do and have no nuclear weapons. But you just have to have good inspection.
So I guess the answer then from you is a qualified yes.
It is possible. No, it's a definite yes, but you just have to have the inspection. I don't know. Norman, do you have a different view?
I would agree on that, but you do have to have a good inspection program. But also, it's really important to notice that without nuclear weapons, we do have a problem that without nuclear power. Namely, we are we're ruining the universe, or our section of the universe, and there seems to be no other substitute as clear for it. So I think that it is going to be inevitable until something else is invented that before too long nuclear power will be here, so in which case we very definitely need to know how to make sure that doesn't lead to nuclear weapons.
In other words, I think you're referring to the fact that many people have suggested that one of the best solutions for global warming is instead of burning carbon, use more nuclear power.
Yes, that's true.
Actually, you know, we were talking earlier about the question of whether exploding a nuclear bomb might ignite the Earth's atmosphere. And Oppenheimer had actually put Teller on this much earlier, I think like in the late 30s or in the early 40s. And
1942.
And Peter and I sort of went back and forth about whether to include that in the opera because, you know, it's a little hysterical given that by that point all of the scientists were basically in agreement that this was not a likelihood. But I wanted to keep it because I thought, first of all, just the fact that this was an issue was alarming. And then I also felt that it was a wonderful metaphor of the human footprint on the planet, that maybe we wouldn't destroy the Earth's atmosphere or ignite the Earth's atmosphere through a nuclear weapon, but if you think about what's going on with global warming, we're just doing the same thing, only at a slower rate.
That's right.
I have a question here for Mr. Cuno. Were there any works of art and or style of art that were specifically reflective of the aftermath of the use of the atomic bomb? And are any of them in the Art Institute?
There is one by an artist named Peter Bloom, and it's called The Rock, and it's typically on view. We're in a state of some compromise in terms of our galleries now because of construction, so I can't say that it is currently. But it was one of these histrionic reactions in a kind of iconographic sense to the destruction of the world. And so people are screaming and tearing, you know, the clothes off, as it were. And so it's a dramatically portrayed moment. I can't say that there was a school of painting or a style of painting that resulted from it. ironically, what happens in the latter 40s and the early 50s is at least among the most progressive and influential artists, is a kind of gradual transition toward a more formal and abstract, that is independent, at least in an obvious sense, independent from any kind of external reference, such that we get a painting that seems to be about color, shape, and form, and so forth, in the 1950s and 1960s, and it goes in a very, very different direction until it gets aptly called minimal in the 60s and 70s. So in some sense, it moves away from that. There are some artists, and again, they tend to be on the margins of things, like Ivan Albright, for example, who seem to show and revel in the kind of melting flesh of these figures as painted, that strikes one like Giacometti as being somehow a reference to the human form born of ashes. But those works, I think, for the most part, tend to be on the margins, and the general trend post 1950 is among the most progressive artists, is to a kind of art that bears seemingly virtually no relationship to the destructive forces of the atom bomb.
Well, there's some of the links that I love to think of are, in the case of Rothko, these edges of the known universe and these worlds inside of worlds, and with Pollock, these universes that you can't find the edge. Where you're embedded in deeply interconnected. To me, one of the most interesting things is they really took the physics of it in a certain way, you know, to this next place that destabilized the still life of those four water bottles and said, well, actually, this other teeming universe is present, and all these imminences, and all this the art of the invisible. In a certain way, and even though they're using paint so visibly on the surface, they're also trying to go into these depths that cannot be accounted for. And to me, that's one of the most exciting parts of that connection.
Yeah, it could be. There is an enhanced sensitivity to the question of existence. You know, that is in a personal sense and a visual sense.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Hmm.
We're almost at the end, so I'm going to have to leave the solution to the moral conundrums posed by atomic weapons to another time. My apologies to those who wanted that done. We have a little time. Before we end, I am told, and I did not need to be told this twice, that it would be the wisest thing to do to let Mr. Peter Sellers have the final word.
Oh, no! That is not safe for anyone.
No, just only to say thank you to the extraordinary range of people present today, and to be really grateful that everybody is working so hard, and let's keep going forward towards the world that we do want to live in. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.